Prajwal.
Hello, Adrienne.
Welcome back to Asia House.
Thank you.
That's quite a long, wonderful introduction. It's a hard act to follow, but I think we can do it. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I love hearing about myself.
So yeah, okay, so let's talk about you.
Okay.
Prajwal was born and grew up in Gangtok in the Sikkim region of northeast India. His father was an Indian Nepali and his mother Nepalese. He was educated at the Truman State University in Missouri, a long way from home, and at Oxford, where he was a writer in residence at the Oxford Hindu Center until just recently. Before committing to a writing career, Prajwal actually worked as an advertising executive for the Village Voice in New York City, which just goes back in time to the rock music center of the world, doesn't it? Village Voice?
After I started working at the Village Voice, it sort of ceased to be as cool as it was in the 90s.
That wasn't because of you.
It may have been because of me, I don't know.
Yeah. In 2011, Prajwal, at the age of 26, was the first, or rather the youngest Indian author to be offered a two-book, multi-country deal, leading him to be labeled the next big thing in Asian fiction. His first book, The Gurkha's Daughter, was a collection of short stories describing the experience of the Nepalese people and the Nepalese diaspora. The Gurkha's Daughter was shortlisted for the 2013 Dylan Thomas Prize, which is one of the leading prizes in the literary world, so it was quite an honor. His novel, Land Where I Flee, was just recently published here in the UK. He's been listed as one of Blackwell's rising stars, and he's one of Time Out's five Asian authors to watch. That's quite a lot to achieve by the time you're, what, 29 now?
I don't know, Adrienne. I don't know anything about the 26-year-old being the youngest Indian author to get a multinational book deal. I honestly question the veracity of that, to be honest with you. It must have been a PR agent who got extremely enthusiastic somewhere. If I am the youngest Indian to have gotten a multinational book deal, I feel awful for my country. I do.
26 isn't that young? Is that what you're saying?
I'm sure there are 19-year-olds writing great books everywhere. So, I don't believe that.
How is this, should we call it a meteoric rise to stardom? How's that affected you in your writing?
Well, you feign embarrassment of it in public and feel extremely smug about it in private. Has that affected my writing? No, not really. You've got to learn not to take these labels too seriously. I think the South Asian media can get extremely generous at times. And, you know, there's this ripple effect at play. The South Asian media goes, he's the next big thing in South Asian fiction. When these papers that were calling me that hadn't even read a word of what I'd written. It was really bizarre. I mean, they were calling me these great names, and I wasn't about to distance myself from them, but they hadn't read a single story I'd written. I hadn't published a single story until after I got the book deal. So you just laugh them off.
Yeah, but enjoy it while you can.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
You started with a book of short stories, and then you moved on to a novel. Was that a big change? Was it hard to move from the short story genre to the novel?
See, Adrienne, I wrote a collection of short stories because I thought it would be easier than attempting to write a novel. I was wrong. Of course I was. Writing the novel was a lot easier than writing the collection of short stories for a few reasons. I wrote the novel after I wrote the collection of short stories. Could it have been that I'd evolved somewhat as a writer between the two books? Mm-hmm. I also wrote the novel at a gorgeous time in my life. It was this wonderful time. I'd just gotten this two-book deal. There were newspapers endowing on me one beautiful sobriquet after another. So everything that could go right was going right. Nothing that could go wrong was going wrong.
But you didn't feel pressured because of all of that.
A little bit. There were times I was lying awake at night, wondering what would happen if I didn't live up to, you know, all these great things.
That's pressure.
That is pressure. There were times, but I realized quickly on that I could either be pressured and take all these things seriously, or just dismiss them, just laugh them off.
Yeah. Land Where I Flee centers on four grown-up children traveling from their homes in the U.S. and the U.K. to Gangtok to celebrate their grandmother's special 84th birthday. Each of them is a disappointment in their own way in their grandmother's eyes. Can you tell us a bit about each one of them and why the grandmother doesn't approve of some of their lives?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are these four orphan siblings that a grandmother has looked after. And they've all moved on abroad. There is the oldest, Bhagwati. I mean, this is a Brahmin family that they come from, an extremely conservative, self-righteous Brahmin family that needs to be kicked where it hurts them the most, sort of like my Brahmin family. And so there's Bhagwati, the oldest, who has eloped with someone of not just the lower caste, but the lowest of the low castes, and a so-called untouchable. The grandmother hasn't been able to forgive her, despite 18 years having elapsed between the elopement and now. And Bhagwati is going to see her grandmother for the first time since the elopement. That's the oldest. Then there is Manasa, who is the second sibling. I've noticed with a lot of South Asian families, if an older sibling has done something wrong, the pressure to do right, do everything by the book, falls on a younger sibling.
Not just Asian families.
Everywhere?
I think so.
Okay, all right. Okay, sure. So Mansa gets married to this man who is from one of the oldest families of Nepal. He's an upper echelon Brahmin and went to Cambridge. She went to Oxford. But a marriage isn't exactly working. And the grandmother hates that. Then there is the older brother called Agastya, who is a closeted homosexual living in New York in a relationship with a nurse. He's a doctor in a relationship with a nurse, and his family has absolutely no clue that he's leading this clandestine existence. And then there is a fourth character called, the youngest sibling called Ruthwa, who is a writer. He has often been remarked in many reviews as Prajwal Parajuli gone bad. he's supposed to be my alter ego, and maybe he is, but I mean, you'll have to be the judge of that when you read the book. So yes, these are four siblings who all convene in their hometown of Gangtok, Sikkim, to celebrate their grandmother's landmark 84th birthday, and secrets threaten to get unraveled. Past follies get revisited. A lot of angst is brought into the picture. So I mean, it makes for a juicy family saga.
And entertaining too, because it's serious, but it's not totally serious. They're entertaining.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Can you read something for us?
Sure. I've spoken to you about Bhagwati, who is the oldest of the siblings. She lives in Boulder, Colorado, has just been fired from her job as a dishwasher. I mean, this is a book full of stereotypes, you know, a South Asian refugee living in America, working as a dishwasher, etc., etc. And she returns home to find her husband, Ram, the untouchable about whom I spoke earlier, rehearsing for something. Okay, and this puts her in a reflective mood. In apartment 213, sprawled on the flowery bed sheet that covered the carpet, was a headphone-decked Ram repeating, "Thank you for calling Domino's. How may I help you?" over and over again. When he noticed Bhagwati, he removed his headphones and smiled. "Got the Domino's job," he said in halting English, and then, moving to the comfort of Nepali, added, "I'm practicing how to answer the phone." "That's nice," Bhagwati faked enthusiasm. "At least one of us will be working." "You're back early," Ram said. "Did you take a half day?" "No, I quit," Bhagwati lied. Ram was quiet. It was getting too much. The man had begun touching me. "What will you do when you get back from India?" "Look for a new job, something that requires more qualification than the kind of jobs illegals do." "A hotel?" Ram asked. "Front desk?" "Reservations, perhaps. No standing up required. When do you start?" "This afternoon," Ram said. "Thank you for calling Domino's. How may I help you?" "That's fine. Now change the do to da. It's not Domino's, but Domino's." "Da, da, da," Ram repeated. "I'll stop now. Will you join me to pray before I head to Domino's?" How ironic it was that her husband, an untouchable, the lowest of the low caste, an upsetting byproduct of the heinous system that her ancestors helped create and propagate, should be so full of piety. He knew the shlokas, memorized elliptical Sanskrit mantras, read the Gita, and understood what festival was celebrated for what reason. He was combative when she, a Brahmin, dismissed Hinduism's many superstitions, made her analyze and reanalyze these beliefs, and furnished her with the scientific reasoning behind them, which she begrudgingly acknowledged. And yet, he could never become a priest. He would never be allowed near the temple of most Hindus. He was a casualty of Hinduism who had chosen not to be a victim. An untouchable who had no shame about his low caste as much as he did of robbing his Brahmin wife of hers on account of a marriage to him. A bigger Hindu, a better Hindu than she or anyone she knew. Ram Bahadur Damai, her husband, whose kind the Christian missionaries had been targeting for centuries, and whose family had stood firm in their devotion to Hinduism, naming their child after a Hindu god. Ram Bahadur Damai, of the Taylor caste, the father of a half-caste children who would thankfully not be taunted in this country for carrying in their bloodline accusations of incest and consanguinity. Ram Bahadur Damai, responsible for the biggest blemish anyone had brought on a family, for belonging to a family of tailors, of alterers and cutters, for altering family dynamics in a way that could never be unaltered, for ripping grandmother from granddaughter in a way they could never be rehemmed. Ram Bahadur Damai, who gave her two sons in whose DNA were Damai blood and Brahmin blood, one infiltrating another, poisoning another, the two sons her grandmother would never touch, whose presence would desecrate her ancestral house. Ram Bahadur Damai, the untouchable kicked out of Bhutan, was a better human being than any of her family members would ever be. Thank you.
Thank you. We've talked about the children, we've talked about the grandmother, but there's another character who plays a huge role in the book, and she's a servant in the household, Prasanti. Can you tell us a bit about Prasanti?
Yeah, I have a eunuch character in the book, a hijra, as eunuchs are known in India, and she is my absolute favorite character. She is irreverent, she is full of nonsense, but she's a real person. Mm. She's also the only person who can break Chitralekha. You know, Chitralekha, the 84-year-old woman, is someone who doesn't listen to anybody, doesn't care about anybody, treats politicians like their dad, plays them like their children, but somehow has a soft corner for Prasanthi, the eunuch servant. I think every writer who grows up in South Asia has a desire to write about eunuchs, especially for a Western audience, because hijras are such fascinating people. And writing about Prasanthi entailed the most research I've ever done for anything in a book. At first, I read two books, and then I realized that my character wouldn't come across as very authentic. So I went to a town close to my hometown, and because eunuchs are not very trusting of men unless and until you want to sleep with them, I had to get a female friend to intervene on my behalf, and of course copious amounts of money were exchanged for a eunuch to share her life story with me. And it's amazing. I mean, these people have their own governments, their own societies. There are gurus, there are chelas, masters and disciples, teachers and disciples. They have their own membership houses where they pay membership dues. They have their own hierarchies. A badai hijra, meaning a eunuch who goes out dancing during celebrations, such as births, weddings, is higher up on the social hierarchy than a eunuch who prostitutes herself. A eunuch who is circumcised as well as castrated is higher up on the pole than a eunuch who is not. So, I mean, writing about it all seemed like a very natural thing to do. I mean, I wanted to write about it before someone else would. And that's how Prasanthi came about.
And Prasanthi's kind of a catalyst in the whole story, isn't she? She kind of stays the same, but she makes things happen around her by the way she treats people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the book, this book had the potential to be very morbid, very Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections-esque book. I mean, it's a great book, but it's depressing. And I think it's a character like Prasanthi.
It's not depressing. That doesn't help sell books.
Okay, all right.
It's not depressing.
I mean, his book is depressing. Mine isn't.
Yeah.
No, mine is great. It's lovely.
Yeah.
Better win the book, or at least be shortlisted for it. But yeah, so Prasanthi is someone who definitely lightens the tone of the book. And my biggest challenge in writing her was I was afraid that she would come across as a caricature, because you're writing about a eunuch, and eunuchs have been caricatured by Bollywood, I mean, since I don't know when, since before I was born. So yeah, I like to believe I've done a decent job of it.
She was great. I loved her.
Thank you.
Something completely different. It's the last question. We're going to clear off the stage for a while. Totally different subject. You have been taking part in the school's workshops that the Literature Festival is organizing with the help of the Balgri Foundation. You went to visit a school in the Midlands. And I was just going to ask you, what sort of advice would you give to young writers? But you were telling me a really interesting story about going to this Midlands school that was 98% Asian.
Yeah, I call it the brownest experience of my life in the UK. No, I hadn't seen anything quite like it. I think there was no non-Asian student in either of the two sessions that I was in. It was fascinating. This was a state school, again, I mean, very, very, very Asian. And talking to these students makes you realize how much more knowledge you can share, because a lot of them had absolutely no clue how one becomes a writer. A lot of them had absolutely no idea about the way the agenting world functioned, or even how publishing functioned. I mean, although it was interesting that everyone knew publishers, you knew the names of publishers such as Penguin and HarperCollins, right. which I thought was refreshing because I didn't know these publishers existed when I was their age. Mm-hmm. But it was great. And I think the foundation is also organizing a short story competition in collaboration with the Asia House that I had the pleasure of judging last year.
Yes, and you'll judge again this year.
Oh, okay, great. No,
You did say yes.
No, I did. And I would love to do it because there is so much talent out there. And if it were not for outreach programs such as this one, I don't think we would really be able to unearth that much talent. I am definitely looking forward to it. It should be fun.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.